Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am thrilled to have this guest on this week. He's a director, he's a producer, he's an author, he's an educator, and he's a podcast host of the podcast Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. It is Mr. Rob Schneider. Hi, Rob.
Donald, thank you so much for having me. I'm such a fan of your show. This is so cool.
Oh, you are? Oh, I didn't know that. Well,
oh,
thank
yes,
you very much.
It's a big deal for me. I'm honored.
Thank you so much. You are here because there is a new series of books out called Essential Musicals from the Methuen imprint.
I need to learn how to say it too.
I actually looked it up. It's Methuen. Methuen imprint of Bloomsbury Publishing. And they are doing a whole series of essential musical books. And you have written queer musicals. It's a wonderful read. I finished reading it a few days ago and then reached out to you so we could chat. And I will be covering the other two editions in a few weeks with the lovely woman who wrote those two books.
Yes.
She'll be on the show to do those. But before we get started, why don't you give the listeners a little background on yourself, where you grew up, and how you became interested in musicals. And I know you got your MFA in musical theater direction from Penn State. I know you have your BA from Cal Lutheran University. So
yes.
Talk about where you grew up and how you got into musicals.
Oh, so I was actually born in Brooklyn, and I was really lucky because my parents were really supportive of the arts from a really early age.
Uh-huh.
And I was like 3 years old. They showed me the movie Singing in the Rain, and I fell madly in love with it. And there was a production of Singing in the Rain playing on Broadway at the time.
Uh-huh.
And so they took me to see that. And then I think a weekend did not go by where we were not at a Broadway show. And I got inundated with it. And so for me, musical theater is as like natural as breathing. It just feels, it's such a part of my DNA now. And so then I realized, like, I watched Singing in the Rain. I was like, oh my gosh, I want to be Gene Kelly. And then I realized, oh, you have to sing and dance to be Gene Kelly.
Yes.
Like, I can't do that. So I was on stage as an actor for a little bit. But then I started to realize directing felt more fun to me. And I started directing professionally when I was 18, because I've always looked like this, which was not great for my teenage years, which is, you know, husky and bald. But people used to be like, oh, he must be much older than he actually is. So I used to convince people to let me direct their shows. And I haven't looked since. That's it in a nutshell.
Okay. And talk a little bit about your podcast. I mean, you do actually more than one, right?
I mean, I do. Yeah, I have a few. Yeah. I'm a producer over at 54 Below in New York City, cabaret space. And we're so lucky we get Broadway's best of the best coming in. And I noticed that in the green room, everybody would sit around and tell these amazing war stories about the shows they worked on and the history of the people they had worked with. And I was like, why is nobody sitting down with these people and asking them to put these stories on tape so they could be preserved? There's a difference, I think, between like reading somebody's story and actually hearing them tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, if nobody's going to do it, I might as well give it a try. And 600 episodes later, we have a pretty good catalog of people that we spoke to. Like, we spoke to George S. Irving, who was in the original Oklahoma. He had great stories. Mimi Hines, Kay Ballard, Nathan Lane, like the list goes on and on. But all of these wonderful stories and all these people from a bygone era, now it's all preserved. And that makes me really happy.
That's amazing. It's an archive. I mean, it's a historical archive.
It is. And I used to think, like, wouldn't it have been great if somebody had been doing this, you know, in the 80s or the 70s, and you could hear, you know, Ira Gershwin tell his story, or you could hear, you know, De Silva, Brown and Henderson tell their journey.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, we'll start now and hopefully get as many people in as we possibly can.
Right.
Yeah. So I do that. And then I do another podcast called Broadway Bound, the musicals that never came to Broadway. And it's a documentary series that looks at musicals that were supposed to come to New York, but for one reason or not, never did. And we use live interviews. We have demos. We have bootlegs. We go to the Library of the Performing Arts and, you know, go through people's archives and read private communication no one's ever heard before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second series that I do.
Cool. And this book, by the way, Queer Musicals, is not your first book. Your first book, it was a book called 50 Key Stage Musicals from 2022.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that also.
Yeah, I was so lucky because I feel bad. I have a lot of friends who are professional authors, and it's so hard for them to find publishers or people that are interested in their work. And I got very lucky because Methuen, mm-hmm. did I say?
Methuen, okay. Yes.
Uh-huh. Methuen. Okay, great. The Methuen said to me, would you be interested in writing this book? And I had never written a book before. And so I said, yeah, why not? So I wish I could say that it was my idea, but it was their idea. And what they want, they have a series called 50 Key, then fill in the blank, 50 Key Movies, 50 Key Painters. And they wanted to do one on musicals. And so my job was to figure out which 50 musicals should be included in this book and then either write the chapters myself on those shows or find people who would be willing to write the chapters on these shows. So I had, for a show queen like myself, it was the greatest honor ever to be told, hey, what do you think are the 50 most important musicals?
But it's not easy.
It's not. And so the criteria that I came up with was, you know, there's a difference between the 50 greatest musicals and 50 key musicals. And for me, key was, if it wasn't for this musical, you wouldn't have had musicals A, B, C, D, and E. So I was looking for things that triggered dominoes. So to be honest with you, there's a lot of shows that I love that are not in the book. And there's a lot of shows that I really don't like, but they are in the book because they are important. Right. So that was sort of our criteria on it. And we're coming out soon with a second edition where we're swapping out some shows from feedback from people that were like, hey, where was this? Or why did you include this when that wasn't included? So there'll be a second edition coming out, I think, in summer of next year.
Oh, cool. You'll have to come back for that one.
I would love that.
That would be great. So when did the Essentials musicals come up? When did they approach you for this one? And did they approach you and specifically say, we want you to do queer musicals? Or did they say, what would you like to do this time?
So they approached me about a year and a half ago and said, we're starting this new series. It's an essential musical series. And these are the categories that are available. And I think they gave me four or five options. And the one that I gravitated towards one was the queer one. Mm-hmm. Because I thought, oh, I think there's a lot of stuff that I can, there's a lot of research here that I can sort of dig in on. Uh-huh. And the trajectory of how like queer characters have been accepted over time, that to me was really an interesting story that I wanted to dig into and that I wanted to tell. So I was lucky. I got to pick it and nobody else picked it. And I said, it's mine now. And I ran with it.
Right. And talk, because each of the books, the authors were allowed to pick 10 musicals. Yeah. To fit into the category. So talk about the selection of the 10, because there were certain criteria you were following, and because you talk about that in the book, in the introduction of the book, and it certainly wasn't easy because it's, you know, trying to do the criteria, follow the criteria and come up with 10 wasn't so easy.
Yeah. And so what was, I was kind of lucky in a way, which was that one of the things that they have on this essential series. And I know when you talk to Kristen, she'll probably tell you this as well, which is they didn't want any musicals covered twice in the series.
Right.
So automatically, I couldn't do Rent, or I couldn't do Strange Loop, or I couldn't do Color Purple, because those were being included in other people's books. So, okay. I was like, well, that frees that up. But then I was like, well, what are firsts? Mm-hmm. I said, if we explore it from the angle of firsts, then I think we would be in good shape. So the first successful musical dealing with queer characters was a 1975 off-Broadway musical called Boy Meets Boy. Mm-hmm. And I started there. And then there were some that were very easy, like La Cage. It's very easy. It's the first musical that featured a gay couple on stage. Okay, that was easy. But then what's interesting is it's like, there haven't really been a lot of musicals where a transgender character is front and center. And as of now, when we're recording in 2025, there's no Broadway musical that's had a trans character front and center as the lead. So I was like, well, where would it be? And I did research and found out there was a musical in 1987 called The Knife, which dealt with transgender issues, but it wasn't well received. But I still wanted to include it because they were the first doing it. It didn't matter if it was successful or not.
Right.
It was that they were the first doing it. So kind of that's sort of how we picked these 10 shows.
Right. And I liked, one of the things I really liked about the book as a whole, and especially about the introduction, is that you also set up, because a lot of these books are, somebody will do, the introduction will be just kind of a cursory, well, you know, I was given the task of picking 10 musicals and it was really hard. And there were, you know, I started with a list of this much and I whittled it down to 10. And here we go. Here's the 10. And you don't do that, because what you do is you give a nice historical context of, you talk about, what I really like is you talk about the different eras of acceptance and or how gays fit in the gay or queer community fit into society. You have the amuse us era, the avoid us era, the assist us era, and the accept us eras. Yeah. And you kind of lay them out and kind of explain that. And I thought that was really a great useful tool, because it kind of lays it out in the different decades of American history of how gay and queer society fit in or didn't fit in, so that when you are looking at the musicals in the decades or the years that they were produced, you can kind of figure this all out. And it really works. It's so helpful from a historical perspective.
Oh, that's so good to hear. Thank you for that. One of the reasons I wanted to include that was because this book is being aimed a lot towards university students. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easy for them to forget, because I teach a lot as well. And in one way, it makes me happy that they think it was always kind of easy. Mm-hmm. Gay people live together all the time and marriages happen all the time. And it was important for me to just remind them it wasn't always this well-received. I mean, it's still not well-received in some areas, but it's not as, it was much harder back then. It was much harder back then. And I just wanted to remind them of that as they're looking at these shows. Like, one of the things, like when I teach Lacage, a lot of my students now get very angry because they go, wait a minute, the two leads were straight actors? Mm-hmm. You know, how is that acceptable? And I'm like, well, you know, you have to remember the time back then. And so I'm happy to hear that you think that the intro does a nice job of setting that up.
It does. It does. I mean, you can tell that the book is designed to be used as a teaching tool, but it's also not dry and academics. And it doesn't read like an academic textbook.
Bless your heart.
Which is so tricky, because there are so many books that I read for the show that are dry academic texts.
Yeah.
It's not. It's entertaining. It's interesting. It keeps flowing. It keeps you enthralled with the whole story and it flows because you set it up so nicely with that introduction that gives the historical perspective. And then you delve into the 10 shows. You do have we'll talk about the honorable mentions later, but you do jump into the shows, and there are shows, 9 of which I was very familiar with, 1 I wasn't, which we will talk about. And I do want to talk about in depth a little bit about some of the shows. But you give a lot of information about all the different shows, and it's all very entertaining. It's got a little bit of gossipy stuff in it. Yeah. It's got a little bit, it's a good read, because not everybody knows everything about Lacage, about the behind the scenes stuff of Lacage, even though it was a huge Tony winning smash. And there are other shows people will not know anything about that are really interesting. And they're part of the history of queer musicals. And that's what it's about. And you don't want it to be a dry, boring academic textbook.
No, honestly, this is the best thing I can hear, because, you write something and you put it out there and you hope that there's a certain response to it. And the fact that when I was working on it, I was like, I don't want it to feel like a dry analysis. And the fact that you're saying that to me, honestly, that's the best review. You've just made my whole day.
Well, because this is, when I saw these series of books were coming out, I know that Bloomsbury does, these kind of, can do a series of academic books. And I was like, well, obviously this looks like it's geared to be a series of academic teaching tool type books. But at the same time, once I started reading them, and I've now read one of the other two books that are out. And they're not necessarily they're books that anybody who is a theater fan could add to their collection and start collecting them and have them on their shelves as a fun reference tool, or as something nice to give as a gift to someone who is becoming a new theater fan or is becoming new, showing new interest in musical theater, to kind of give them an introduction to musicals. And are finding their way into this. And this is a perfect, this book is also perfect because it's tackling a subject, queer musicals, that has not been tackled like this before, I don't think.
No, it has, not to my knowledge. And if it has, it's usually very, it is dry a lot of the time. And to me, that's not exciting. You know, I, like you had mentioned earlier, I'm a director. And so for me, I'm like, well, what's the story that we want to tell? You know, it would be very, honestly, it would have been very easy to be like, the show opened in August and then in July this happened. And then it's, you know, but I was like, that's not interesting to the reader. I'm like, right. what is the story of each of these shows? And so once I, then I'm like, I'm hoping that the reader will then go, oh, this is an interesting story. And I'm learning at the same time, as opposed to fact, here's a fact, here's a fact, here's a fact.
Right. And you also very successfully get across why the show is important historically, why it's influential, why it's unique. That's the other tricky. That's the other hard thing, is because in many cases, these shows are very unique. Within the subgenre of being a queer musical, so they're very unique and different from each other within this particular category. I want to start our talk about some of these musicals with where you start, which is Boy Meets Boy, which is the first one in the book. Talk about that. It's sort of a deceptive show in the sense that it's a throwback romantic comedy. It's sort of a pastiche boyfriend type show. But the characters are men and the romance is gay, but it's not necessarily. It's a bit subversive in the sense that it's not designed to be a protest or in your face musical. It's just designed to be a cute romantic comedy. But wait a minute, the romantic couple are two guys.
Yeah,
you know, and that's how it gets its point across.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. So in the early 1970s, there was a huge nostalgia craze on Broadway. With like No No Nanette and Grease, even though it was an original musical, was looking back in the past.
And Irene.
And I think Good News came in, and Very Good Eddie came in. So all of these shows were being revived. And the writers of Boy Meets Boy wanted to capitalize on that, but they thought, how do you do it and stand out? And so they were huge fans of 1930s screwball comedies, like, you know, What Happened One Night or The Palm Beach Story. And so they said, well, what if we do one of those stories, but it's about two gay guys? And the idea would be that there would never be a moment in the show where the people in the show go, they're gay? Or like, oh, two men? In the premise of the show is the idea that homosexuality is totally accepted. So there's never anything homophobic. There's never any character that's like, gay people can't be together, you know? And it's very light and fluffy and buoyant. And that went a really, really long way, because if you were part of the queer community, you were seeing something that was accepting of your lifestyle and showing you a world that could possibly be if everyone was tolerant. And then if you weren't gay and you were able to go in and go, oh, this is old school. This is like Cole Porter. It's nostalgic. It just happens to be a guy playing that role. So it was kind of the best of both worlds for everybody. And it was a huge hit off Broadway. It was a huge hit. It ran for about a year and a half, 2 years. Everybody had seen it. Everybody had loved it. And then they wanted to take the show on tour. And to me, this is what we talk about in the chapter. Imagine if you're a young queer person in like Idaho or Ohio or Oregon, and you don't think you're, you know, you think you're odd. And then this musical comes to town that shows you, no, you're not odd. You know, this is normal. But the producers and the writers got into a huge legal battle with one another. And so they couldn't do the show on tour and the show disappeared. So we had we had the power to help change people's lives. And because of a discrepancy, you'd have to wait another 10 years or so until Lacage comes around.
Yeah, that's the thing that's so fascinating about that whole chapter on Boy Meets Boy is that it's this huge missed opportunity. You know, you have this delightful show that is embraced by audiences in New York. And even if it had just toured major metropolitan cities, even if it just played big cities like Los Angeles or San Francisco or whatever, the reach of the suburban areas around those big cities would have reached so many young gay people who were looking for the ability to see themselves on stage and accepted and whatever. It would have touched so many people if it had been able to go on tour. But because of infighting behind the scenes, it was a huge missed opportunity.
Yeah, infighting. And, you know, as before we went on the air, I was talking, you know, Donald has an amazing CD collection behind him. And you know, the way a show lives on and touches people a lot is through the albums. And the fact Boy had one, but it wasn't well produced and it wasn't good. And
I do have a copy of it sitting right
here. Fantastic. Oh, my gosh. Yes, you do. Oh, wait, that makes me happy.
Which is, but it got a homemade cover. So,
I love the homemade cover though. That looked great.
Yes.
So because of that, like the show didn't have the life it could have had.
Right.
And it could have gone further. And it, you know, listen, I'm a huge believer in that if you want to enlighten or educate people, you have to do it through entertainment. And that's just me. I think you get more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. And I think Boy Meets Boy would have changed a lot of people's perspectives had it been allowed to have the life it should have had.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's sort of a bittersweet story in it. And it doesn't feel like it's the kind of show that's really revivable at this point. It just...
Yeah, I mean, unless you did it like at a tiny off-Broadway theater and you really lean, or if Encores did it, like you really have to lean into the style. And it is very dated now. The 30s style is incredibly dated.
Right.
And I think today people want more. I think people would want a character that goes, you know, gay people are bad.
Different time.
Love's okay for a rainy day or to while away the blues. But when love gets serious, brother, that's bad news. There's just too much to lose. The life of gay abandon, of excursions and alarms,
the pick of all the ladies and their charms,
the right to spend each evening in a brand new fella's arms. Imagine giving all of it up for love. The nightclubs and the taxis and the tickets to the smash,
the girls adore that fancy free panache.
You get the best of both worlds, from cliche bun to mustache.
Imagine giving all of it up for love, telling one another
you be home by 10.
Please be nice to mother,
don't you dare go out with other men.
Why go and sell your birthright for a mess of cottage pie, and marry just one girl
or just one guy? What have we got in common with each other, you and I? We both would state to abdicate is not worth thinking of. We can imagine giving all of it up for Lent, but heavens above, imagine giving it up for love.
You did mention briefly the next show that I want to talk about, which was a show that I had heard of, but had not really, did not know much about the background of it. And that is The Knife.
Yeah.
Which is the transgender, the show that tackles some transgender issues, starring Mandy Patinkin, of all people.
Starring the one and only Mandy
The one and only Mandy Patinkin. So talk about that. I mean, you don't have to give too much away, because we want people to actually buy the book and read about it. But it's a really fascinating, fascinating story about the development of the show and how it seemed to have so much, I mean, it seemed to have so much kind of going for it, and then completely crashed and burned. In a lot of ways.
Yeah. So there was a British playwright named David Hare, and he's still around, but his stuff was, I mean, in the '80s, he was sort of the go-to playwright. He was very political, very contemporary. And Joe Papp at the Public Theater, who was the producer of the Public Theater, loved David Hare and sort of gave him carte blanche. He's like, do whatever you want. And David Hare said, well, actually, he goes, I want to do a musical, which he had never done before. But Joe Papp was like, great, go for it. And he said, well, what do you want it to be about? And he goes, there was, I want to make it about a guy who's realizing he was born the wrong gender. And Joe Papp said, great, go for it. So this was Joe Papp at the Public. The Public had given us a chorus line. David Hare, who was the hottest playwright around at the time, and to star in it was going to be Mandy Patinkin, who was also the biggest Broadway star at that particular time for guys. And so, like you said, this has like everything going for it. This should be a home run, a slam dunk. And unfortunately, when you read the chapter, you'll realize why it wasn't as successful as it could have been. There's no album of it, and it's not available for licensing, but I did get my hands on a script, and I did get my hands on a bootleg of the show. And I do hate to say, it's not a very good show. It's a very missed opportunity.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. It sounded really fascinating, and it sounds like one of those shows that you really want to see it or read it just to see what, even if it's a fail, even if it failed, you still kind of want to see what the attempt was, because you want to see how they handled the whole transgender thing at that point and what the approach was. And if it's that much different than how it's handled now.
What was really sad for me on this one was we weren't allowed in the book to use lyrics or dialogue that. Because of copyright issues for every chapter, not just The Knife, because I really wanted people to see how the story was being told. And I mean, I think the big thing is that their idea of how somebody becomes transgender, I think, is very different from how we see it today. So for example, in this particular show, what happens is Mandy Patinkin's character runs into a woman and she's naked. He bumps into her naked and he looks at her body, and the woman says to him, this is so interesting. She goes, it's the first time I've been naked in front of a guy, and I feel like he doesn't want to have sex with me, but he wants to be me. And like a light bulb goes off, and he goes, yes, I do. And then the whole rest of the show is, so it makes it feel like his transgenderism is a spur of the moment decision. As opposed to, I think, what we know today, and that's not really the case. So I don't know if that would fly.
Right. Interesting.
Listen, everyone's heart was in the right place.
Right.
You know, nobody was making, if you read, they're not making fun of transgender people. The critics did. And I think in the chapter, we talk about some of the horrible things the critics say. But like the authors, that was not their intention. That was not their intention. So
yeah.
I think they deserve some credit for that.
Yeah. That's why I think it's a really fascinating chapter to read about a show that I think is really going to be unknown to a lot of readers. They're not going to know anything about that one.
And I will say, I have no problem doing this. Like, if anybody reads the chapter and wants more information, just hit me up and I'll send you the bootleg and I'll send you the script.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Just reach out to Rob.
Yes, please.
And he will fill you in. Now I want to move on. A little bit earlier, I mentioned the fact that one of the things I really love about the book is that it also shows you that in the kind of the universe of queer musicals, especially in this book, they don't all neatly fit into one box. there is sort of, and I didn't even mean that to come out the way it did, especially because, because of the next show, there is a song about something in a box, but that's because they're all very unique and very different from each other. And that's why I want to talk about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, because it is, not only is the show so unique in terms of its subject matter, but the development of the show and the creation of the show is totally different than maybe anything in that you can think of, even just in the history of Broadway musicals or off-Broadway musicals, in the sense that it developed out of a character created by John Cameron Mitchell out of the New York alternative club scene that wasn't necessarily in the theater development pipeline at all. I mean, not even close to the theater development pipeline. And then Stephen Trask comes on board, and then you got a director comes on board and a producer comes on board, and it just somehow takes life and becomes an off-Broadway musical that nobody even really knows who the audience for this thing is for. I mean, is it supposed to appeal to the downtown punk audience, because they don't know what to make of it, and the musical theater uptown crowds don't know what to make of it, and yet in the end it all gels and becomes, the critics find it and the critics get it, and the audiences ultimately get it, and it becomes this thing.
Okay, everybody. Appearance and makeup. Turn on the 8-track. Now I'm pulling away down from the show.
Talk about Hedwig. It's probably one of the most fascinating stories, I think, in theater history, because it's so absolutely unique from anything else. And it brings up something totally unique to the book and to this whole concept of queer musicals in the whole genderqueer concept. And this is also where you talk about the different types in American history of drag. Because there are the three different phases of drag performance in American performances. So talk about all that, because it's a totally fascinating musical and chapter.
Oh my gosh, thank you. And actually this is the chapter I was dreading the most, because I knew the least about this show.
Going oh really? In.
Yeah, I don't know how. I'd never seen the movie. I had never seen.
Oh really? I saw the movie before I ever saw it on stage.
Oh, I love that. Okay, great.
The movie absolutely blew me away. I was like, this is like the most fascinating, wild, amazing thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, yeah. And I, you know, full disclosure, like I think that this show had come out, I think, when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my friends knew it and loved it, but I was like the golden age guy. I was like, I don't want to see.
Right. And it wasn't my kind of show either, really.
Yeah.
But.
And so I was like, oh boy, I'm like, I know I need to include it, but let me just start doing my research. And then, like you said, the fact that its development was so weird and out there and like nothing had ever seen before. So John Cameron Mitchell was a very respected Broadway child actor. Mm-hmm. He had done 6 Degrees of Separation. He had done Secret Garden. But he would go down to this club downtown and he's like, oh, I kind of want to perform. But the club had a rule. They're like, well, it's a drag club. So like you have to come out and do drag. And he was like, okay, let me come up with an idea or a character. And at that time, a lot of like drag persona was, you know, somebody would get in drag and they would lip sync to Diana Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would come out and they'd lip sync to Madonna. Or they would sing live, but it would be a Diana Ross or a Madonna song. He goes, well, I don't want to do that. So he got into drag, but he created a character. And he would sing like weird popular songs of the day as this character in drag. And he gave her a backstory about she lived in Germany and like you said, it started to morph. And then all these people were like, wait a minute, there might actually be like a show in this. Like you could take this thing you're doing on drag night for fun and make a story out of it. Like you said, then a composer got involved to give him original material. Then a director got involved to shape it. And it ended up, a producer saw it and was like, I want to do this. But like you said, they didn't know where this thing should go.
Right.
Like if it stays downtown, the rich old people from uptown are not going to come down to see this. This isn't mm-hmm. their show.
Mm-hmm.
But if you tell like the club kids, this is a musical, they're going to go, my grandparents listen to musicals. Like, I don't want to see this. So the fact that this thing even had any sort of life whatsoever is incredible. And the production, what I love about it is like the producer was just telling people like, hey, just go to the ATM, get me cash, give me the cash. And I'll use, like, there was no like checks. There was no LLC. Like, you know, it wasn't like the Schuberts are bidding on it. I was literally people going to an ATM.
It was like it was like Mickey and Judy. Let's put on a show. But it was New York club kids.
I mean, it was New York club kids.
It was insane.
And it's, and they ended up going to, they were like, well, we want to do it in a place that's like a middle ground. Like, it's not Broadway, but it's not all the way downtown. So they were like, we'll go to the Jane Street Hotel, which was this hotel on the West Side that was the most dangerous. Like, I mean, it was a place for sex workers and drug addicts to go. Mm-hmm. And on open night of Hedwig, while the crowd was waiting outside, somebody had OD'd. And they had to hold the show and hold people coming in. So the audience outside is waiting while like somebody's body in a body bag is being carted out. And they were like, is this part of the show? Is that real? Mm-hmm. So the whole show had that kind of vibe to it. But I think it really spoke to a generation. It was rock. It was edgy. It told a really unique, interesting story about like, who is to say what love really is? And I think in the late 90s, that was something people wanted to talk about and explore. So it was a cool musical. As much as people love Rent, I think Hedwig actually had more of its finger on the pulse of what people wanted to express at that time.
Right.
Rent, wonderful as it is, it's still pretty well-made structure. I mean, it's La Boheme, just contemporary. Uh-huh. And I think Hedwig was like, we're going to go a step further. And I think,
And it tackles some interesting, because there's some really interesting questions in Hedwig that you talk about in the chapter, in the sense that the whole angry inch issue of the surgery and whether or not is Hedwig transgender or not, and the issue, possibly not, because the surgery is undertaken not necessarily because they're transgender. And the whole there's a lot of questions about the character and a lot of questions about Itzhak and about it's a very complicated, it turns out to be a very complicated story. There's so much depth to the story that you don't think is going to be there.
No, and it's, listen, you're hearing, oh, it's about 13 to 15 songs. It's on a club stage. It's a drag queen. So, what's this going to be? And then you end up leaving and you have so many questions about life and preconceived notions. And like you said, if you're familiar with Hedwig, you know that he goes through the surgery to marry a man just so that way a man could be married to a woman. It has nothing to do with the fact, like in The Knife, where he goes, well, I've always feel like I've lived, I wanted to be a woman. He's never, this is more done as a means to an end for him.
Sun is in your eyes, and hurricanes and rains blacken cloudy skies. You're running up and down that hill, you turn it on and off at will. There's nothing here to thrill or bring you down. And if you've got no other choice, you know you can follow my voice through the dark turns and noise of this wicked little town. Lady Luck has led you here. So twisted up, they twist you up by fear. The buyer's hateful and devout, you're turning tricks till you're turned out. The wind's so cold it burns, you're burning out, blowing round. And if you've got no choice, you know you can follow my voice through the dark turns and noisy wicked little town. The fates are vicious and the cruel. You learn too late, you used to wish it like a fool. And then you're someone you are not. Injunctions did paint the spot. Remember Mrs. Lott, and when she turned around. And if you've got no other choice, you know you can follow my voice through the dark turns and noise of this wicked little town.
And then it ends up on Broadway. Ultimate, you know, the revival ends up on Broadway.
Yeah, with good old Neil Patrick Harris. And that's one where you're like, how is this going to Broadway? This show that's supposed to be done in a seedy little club. I mean, that's the whole point of the show. The point is that Tommy, his ex-lover, is, you know, playing Madison Square Garden, playing, you know, the MetLife Stadium. I mean, and he's in this tiny little area. So if it's on Broadway, how does this work? And I think they solved it on Broadway in a very clever manner, that they had broken into the theater to tell the story. And I think that's a smart way of doing it.
Yeah. Hedwig I'm really glad to see that you included it in the book. And I think it's a fascinating chapter because it really does show to me the broad universe of what falls into the category of a queer musical.
Thanks.
And that they're all, every single one of the shows that's in the book is unique from each other.
Yeah,
they're all very different.
Good. That makes me happy. I was hoping that nothing felt like, didn't we just cover this?
Yeah, no, they're all very different in different ways, you know? And then, you know, the last show I want to talk about is the last show in the book, which is Jagged Little Pill, which is also such a very strange story because it's, you know, all the show people have been bemoaning, you know, the jukebox musicals,
yeah.
And how they've not been succeeding very much on Broadway, but they finally get Alanis Morissette's smash hit Grammy winning album turns into a jukebox musical with the help of Diablo Cody writing a script and Diane Paulus directing, and it opens just before pandemic to good to excellent reviews, and they turn it into, you know, which appears to be a really great jukebox musical, because they've added a storyline to it that is about a family. And then after the pandemic and shows reopen, we get sort of a kind of a abbreviated version of the Tony Awards, and the show is nominated for 15 Tonys. But then things just can't play out properly because it then becomes a victim of its own success with issues about how they handled a non-binary character, and that brings up all sorts of other issues. So talk a little bit about the story of Jagged Little Pill.
Yeah, I had such high hopes for this show because I had seen it out of town in Boston, and I thought it was the greatest jukebox musical that had ever been created, because it was the first time they were using a jukebox musical, one, to tell a very serious story, but a contemporary story, which we don't really have. I mean, Mamma Mia is fluffy and Jersey Boys is looking in the past. So this really hadn't been done before. And I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And the main issue was there's a character in the show that was played by Lauren Padden. And she plays one of the character's girlfriends. She's a lesbian. Out of town in Boston, she was non-binary. And also there was hints that maybe she was also transgender. Anyway, when the show moved to New York, they were like, and this was actually the problem with the show. The show wanted to talk about everything. I mean, right. every single issue you could imagine was like fully on display in this particular show. So they were like, we have to like cut some things back. And so they were like, well, let's not worry about making this character non-binary or transgender. We just can't cover that right now. So they cut it. And then a bunch of people got really angry. And they said, wait a minute. This was going to be the first non-binary character. You've taken that away from us. You know, how dare you? And what the writers and the producers should have done, I think, is they should have said, yes, we did, because this show is covering a lot of topics. Uh-huh. We have to focus the show. But this idea of being non-binary or transgender, it's such a big topic. It deserves its own story.
Uh-huh.
So that's why we're eliminating it here in this particular one. They didn't do that.
Right.
Instead, what they said was, oh, she was never supposed to be non-binary. And in this day and age, the kids go, well, I've got the receipts. And they are like, well, I saw the show. And on the show, she's in Boston, she said this line, and she was wearing, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I can't even think of the term for it right now. It's a thing to like, if you're female identifying, you wrap it around your breast to flatten your breast. So I can't remember the name of that garment right now. But she was wearing that in the show. And so then, unfortunately, there were people that tweeted Lauren Patton saying, oh my gosh, to see a non-binary character, it means so much. And she would respond back to it saying, thank you. So they were lying. They were acting like, oh no, this never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the problem. That was the problem. But what I love about including it as the last chapter in the book is think back 40 years earlier on Lacage, where it's like, we can't have any gay actors in this thing, and the straight actors have to constantly remind everyone that they're gay, that they're straight and they're playing gay characters. So to go from that to Jagged Little Pill being like, no, you have to be non-binary to be in this role. You have to do, to me, what a revolution. Like, mm-hmm. what a 180
mm-hmm.
to me. And I think, and to me, I'm like, that's fascinating. Full disclosure, Jagged Little Pill doesn't really do anything. The show itself, the story itself, it doesn't really do anything for queer storyline, does it?
Mm-hmm.
It's everything around it that became part of moving the queer needle forward, because now you really can't do a musical with a queer character and that actor not be queer.
I'm broke, but I'm happy. I'm poor, but I'm kind. I'm short, but I'm healthy, yeah. I'm high, but I'm grounded. I'm sane, but I'm overwhelmed. I'm lost, but I'm hopeful, baby. And what it all comes down to is that everything's gonna be fine, fine, fine. 'Cause I've got sober. I'm young and misunderstood. I'm tired, but I'm working, yeah. I care, but I'm restless. I'm here, but I'm really gone. I'm right, and I'm sorry, baby. And what it all comes down to is that everything's gonna be quite alright. 'Cause I've got I'm brave, but I'm chicken shit. I'm sick, but I'm prey, baby. And what it all boils down to is that no one's really got it figured out just yet. But I've got one hand in my palm. The bell can blow me.
What I also wanted to talk about is because it brought up, it kind of brought up a lot of issues beyond just the non-binary character. It brought up the issues of what freedoms, what artistic freedoms do the writers and creators of the show have in changing things, and how careful do they have to be in changing things, and how they publicly do handle those things. Because if you're going to have a character that is a lesbian out of town and you come into town and suddenly they're bisexual, or they're now straight when they get to Broadway. Yeah. There is artistic freedom, and they should be able to have make the artistic choice in terms of for the character or for the purposes of the story or whatever, to be able to make changes. But it's how do you handle it, and how do you handle casting a show, and how do you it brought up so many different weird issues or unique issues that I don't think were on people's radar. It just brought up so many issues. Just that one incident suddenly brought up all these huge issues for writers and creators and producers and directors and actors, because the actors all got involved. And that to me was the crazy part, was that you suddenly had cast members chiming in, and it then brings up questions about why are cast members trashing their own show and making, sort of like, it became such a strange situation for a show to have all this bad publicity stuff going on within the show. And it brought up a lot of issues of somehow we had turned a corner or crossed to a new line that I don't think we had seen before.
And that's why Jagged Little Pill to me is important, because now honestly, you're kind of seeing this now with maybe Happy Ending.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
With who's allowed to, basically it's who's allowed to tell these stories.
Right.
And when, and does the artist, does the writer have a say in it anymore? Uh-huh. And my feeling is, if they go, when she's non-binary or when they're non-binary, it's not working for the show, they have every right to change it. But audiences now feel a lot of ownership in a show. It's brought up a whole bunch of things, but like you were saying, like with the cast, there was so much virtue signaling. And what I loved is the people in the cast that were complaining, saying, well, I'm not coming back to Jagged Little Pill, because they're treating our trans brothers and sisters incorrectly. They weren't planning on coming back anyway. They all had other shows lined up.
Right.
And then they used that as an excuse. And I'm like, oh, come on. It was very frustrating.
Yeah.
But it brings up 100 million different issues.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing that makes it worrisome for me is that it concerns me when things like that happen, because it makes me fearful that there will be producers or especially producers out there or directors who will be hesitant about taking on shows with touchy, difficult subject matter because they're afraid of stepping into a minefield. With that kind of stuff, that they don't want to necessarily get involved in a show that could have a similar experience down the road, and they don't want to have to deal with that,
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate. I think now I think the way the trend's going to move, honestly, is that I think people realize everyone's going to get canceled at some point.
Right.
Everyone's going to get called out. So you know what? Like, I think maybe Happy Ending is a great example of this right now, which is, I think there was a lot of screw ups on that one, but much earlier than just casting Andrew in the role. And I think what people are going to go is, okay, we're going to get yelled at for 2 days, and then someone else is going to screw up and they're going to get yelled at for 2 days, and then they're going to forget about us. So I feel like Jagged Little Pill was the first show to really get quote unquote canceled.
Uh-huh.
And so I think they overcompensated.
Yeah.
And they just stood firm and said, listen, this is how it goes. But it also brings up another question, which is the community said, well, if the character is non-binary and Lauren Patton is binary, she shouldn't be playing the role. So then if the producers fire her, is that a lawsuit?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you, in an audition or a job, which is a job interview,
you can't ask.
You legally can't ask them.
Right.
So, it's such an interesting minefield that we're walking into now.
Yeah, exactly.
But it did. I feel like when historians look back on this 50, 100 years from now, I think Jagged Little Pill is going to be the first, like, earthquake.
I want you to know that I'm happy for you. I wish nothing but the best for you both. The perfect version of me, is he perverted like me? Would he go down on you in a theater? So he speaks eloquently and you can have his baby. I'm sure you'd make a really excellent mother. 'Cause the love that you gave that we made wasn't able to make it enough for you to be open wide. And every time you speak his name, does he know why you told me you'd be there until you died? Till you died, but you're still alive. And I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away. It's not to deny me of the cross I bear that you gave to me. You ought to know. You seem very well. Things look peaceful. I'm not quite as well. I thought you should know.
Points on both sides, you know, and I, you know,
it was a situation that didn't need to happen if it had been handled better.
I mean, listen, I think, you know, I'm not non-binary, but I think that the non-binary community had just been told, like, listen, this is too big of an issue for us to just deal with in a cursory manner. Lauren was a periphery character in the show.
Mm-hmm.
She was a periphery character in the show. The show's problem was it had 100 characters in it,
right,
and they all had 50 issues. So, like, they had to focus it, which mm-hmm. is what happens out of town in a musical.
Right.
You focus it.
Right. And sometimes you lose your song, or sometimes you lose big scenes, and sometimes characters disappear altogether.
Characters disappear.
Yeah.
So listen, this is one to me that I think people are going to be studying for a really, really long time. And it was important for me to include it in the book, especially as the last chapter, because to me, it's triggering a whole new wave of how we're going to be looking at queer characters in musical theater. But like I said, to go from like a Boy Meets Boy, where originally they were like, well, maybe we'll change the title so nobody thinks it's too gay, to this, mm-hmm. where it's people, how dare you get rid of queer characters and queer actors? And why aren't queer actors or non-binary actors? That's in 50 years? That's a pretty big revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to point out, because we mentioned it really briefly earlier on, and that was another thing I really, really liked is that in the introduction, you included honorable mentions.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was really useful because in addition to the 10 musicals that you focused on and wrote big chapters on, you also included a list of honorable mention musicals so that people, and you didn't just list them, you actually kind of gave a little tiny brief blurb about each one to give an idea of what they were about and significance, et cetera, so that people have some other musicals that they can check out that are also interesting queer musicals to think about.
Yeah.
Of those, were there like one or two of those that you really are favorites of yours that you wish you could have included in the 10 that you really like?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, we say Boy Meets Boy, but like the first real one, but it was very serious and conceptual, was an Al Carmine's musical called The Faggot, which was from the early 70s. Mm-hmm. That I would love to have included, but honestly, it didn't have the same impact that Boy Meets Boy did. So that's one I would love to have included. I'm trying to think what else was on that honorable mention list. Isn't that horrible? Oh, there was one called Southern Comfort.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't heard of that one.
Which was at the Public Theater. It was based on a documentary about a transgender individual in the South. That was one I had wanted to include, but it didn't really have, the reviews weren't incredible. The show itself had some trouble. So that was one I wish I could have included, but there wasn't enough to, knock one of these other shows off the page. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, thank you again for taking the time to chat about the book Queer Musicals, brought to us by Methuen, imprint from Bloomsbury, from their Essential Musicals series. And also want people to check out your Behind the Curtain podcast. Who do you have guests coming up to? Can you reveal?
Well, yeah, I'm going to be fully honest with you. We stopped doing it in the pandemic. So we have a backlog of 600 interviews. But I will point you in the direction. When we stopped, there's a wonderful young man, and by a young man, I mean, he's like 15, named Charles Kirsch.
Uh-huh.
And he picked up doing what we were doing. He
has a
podcast called Backstage Babble.
Oh, yeah.
And it's incredible. So like once you either listen to the old ones and ours, and if you're like, well, I want to keep hearing something that's still going, go to Charles Backstage Babble.
Okay. And where can they find you?
They can, for podcasting?
Yeah.
On the Broadway Podcast Network, but anywhere you get your podcasts, we're there. But we are doing a third season of Broadway Bound. So I would encourage people to listen to that.
And what do you have coming up episode-wise? Can you reveal?
Ooh. Yeah, actually, tell me what you think. So each season is thematically linked.
Uh-huh.
And so our first season was movies that were being turned into musicals that never came in.
Uh-huh.
And then our second season was called You're As Only As Good As Your Last. And it was big writers who had shows not come in from out of town. So right now I'm playing around with the idea of the season's either going to be thematically linked by star vehicles that didn't come in, or musicals that closed in previews, or they were on Broadway but they never got to an official opening night.
Oh god, okay. Interesting.
So those are the two that I'm playing with now. So if you've got an idea, or your listeners have an idea, hit me up. I'm on Instagram at Rob W. Schneider. Hit me up and let me know what you think.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. Well, Rob, it's been delightful to have you here and great to finally meet you virtually anyway. Hopefully soon in person. But I encourage people, please pick up Queer Musicals. It's wonderful. And where would you like people to find the book?
Oh my gosh, it is on Amazon. I will say we're in a really great position, which is I think it's on back order now on Amazon because so many people have purchased a copy. So yay. Uh-huh. But you know, if you want to support a local bookshop, you know, go to the Drama Bookshop online, which is based in New York, order from them. The Strand Bookstore I know has it. I think Barnes & Noble is going to start carrying it. So, but you know, or you can go directly to Methuen and order it on their website. So it's available anywhere. It's whatever's most convenient for you.
Perfect. That's what I will have people do. I'll include those links on the website so they can find your book. Thanks again for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.